This is an unfortunate case involving tragic circumstances, the death of an individual, Tyrone Moody. It was the result of a horrendous evening and an environment in which Paris Hamilton arrived at a residence depressed from the death of his grandmother, drinking heavily, prior contemplating suicide with a gun in his backpack, having plans to... He decided to stay alive because he wanted to go meet with his son to play video games with his son, and he knew where his video game was. It was in the apartment of his girlfriend's, who asked him previously a few weeks earlier to move out. And he went to that apartment with the intent of being able to retrieve his Sony PlayStation with the goal of leaving to go play video games with his son. A horrendous set of circumstances ensued at that residence. He was allowed into the residence by Christopher Moody, the son of Crystal Moody.
How old is Christopher?
Christopher at the time, I believe, was approximately 15 to 16 years old. Now, at that point in time, or prior to that, Paris Hamilton had paid for the telephone bill, which included the cable, which included internet access for the household. He had his personal belongings within the household. He was asked to leave, although he had an oral contract to be able to reside there with his girlfriend. He voluntarily left, but he still had a lot of items, including clothing, in addition to the Sony PlayStation there that evening. He entered into the household with permission, and that part is not disputed by the state, but that's when a cavalcade of horrendous events took place. An argument took place over the retrieval of the Sony PlayStation.
And who was that argument with?
It was with various different individuals. It was with Crystal Moody and with Tyrone Moody. And Christopher Moody was sent to go retrieve the Sony PlayStation upstairs.
What was the argument with Tyrone?
Tyrone acted defensively to protect his mother and stepped in front of Paris Hamilton, and an argument within the two of them ensued. Now, all this comes down to a situation in which Paris Hamilton had a gun in his backpack, took out that gun in his backpack, and started shooting. He shot repeatedly. He shot Tyrone Moody. He shot Crystal Moody. He shot Christopher Moody. After that, a hostage situation took place in which it's not relevant to the issues here necessarily, but eventually Paris Hamilton gave himself up to law enforcement after making numerous comments which would make one believe that he was hoping for a goal of suicide by police officer. I should note, Your Honor, I did ask the clerk to reserve 8 minutes. What happened during the trial is what I'll assert was the first error, is the state's expert was allowed to opine that the professed defense of extreme emotional distress, it was not available if there was any use of alcohol.
And that was in response to cross-examination?
Correct.
Was that your cross-examination?
It was first in part of the direct examination. An objection was raised at that time, and the court did not allow a sidebar to take place to discuss that. Instead, the trial judge noted that, and this is on page A82, in a request for a sidebar, no, I will explain, ladies and gentlemen, what the law is on extreme emotional distress in my instructions, which I'll be giving you probably tomorrow. The doctor is explaining it from his point of view, the point of view of his understanding of it as a psychiatrist.
Well, what did the judge do? What was the error, and why is it reversible?
First, the judge should have issued a curative instruction as of that moment. That is an incorrect statement of law. The expert, who already has a higher degree of credibility than most after being qualified as an expert.
But it wasn't a statement made by the prosecutor.
No, it wasn't.
And it wasn't a statement endorsed by the prosecutor, correct?
It is not, although I would say a statement.
So isn't the issue whether that statement has any legal impact at all? That is, whether any legal consequence should be attached to it, because it's not a comment by the prosecutor.
I would assert that comments from a prosecutor, although this court has been troubled by that and required instructions, during a closing argument, a jury is already told. Arguments of the lawyers are just that, arguments. They're not evidence. In this case, this was evidence. It was evidence by an expert witness, and it was evidence in which...
Well, I'm asking you whether that's an issue.
It is certainly an issue.
Your argument is that even though the witness wasn't a prosecutor, the fact that he expressed a personal understanding of the impact of imbibing alcohol on this defense, and the judge not instructing the jury immediately after, was an error.
It was error because it was raised as an objection. The court didn't permit the objection to even be properly summarized on the record by denying a sidebar. And the effect of it was the expert was allowed to repeatedly make the misstatement.
Why was it reversible error if it was error?
Well, it was reversible error from the standpoint of if the judge properly cured it in the closing argument, it would be less prejudicial. I would certainly concede that. But the trial judge did not correct this. On page A72, during the prayer conference, we specifically asked the court to indicate, as my co-counsel noted, I was going to ask the court to say if the defendant's mental state was caused by voluntary intoxication, and then the language, and not by extreme emotional distress. That was needed because the jury instruction instead indicated one sentence, and this is on A97, the fact that a person consumed alcohol does not necessarily preclude a finding of extreme emotional distress.
Is that a correct statement of the law?
It is a correct, limited statement of the law, but it doesn't encompass the set of facts that was before this jury. No one was taking a position that Paris Hamilton did not have alcohol in his system. What the jury needed to be instructed is how to differentiate between evidence and argument of intoxication and use of alcohol, how to factor in use of alcohol in determining whether the individual's state of mind was the product of alcohol or whether it was the product of extreme emotional distress.
But your argument boils down, if I understand it correctly, to the contention that even though the judge properly instructed the jury on the law, the judge erred by not instructing immediately after the opinion by the expert was uttered.
The judge first erred.
Is that right?
The judge first erred by not making the curative. That is, while I will not concede that it is an accurate statement of the law under the set of facts, and that is because in most cases this would have been an accurate statement of law, except for the fact of here there is evidence of intoxication and there's argument of intoxication. And under that set of circumstances, the jury instructions needed more language, as we expressly requested the court, so that the jury would be able to understand what it was that they were determining. They were determining the extent that the alcohol affected the state of mind.
You're saying that the judge erred not only in failing to give a curative instruction immediately after the offending opinion was uttered, but that also that the instruction that was ultimately given is incorrect?
Yes.
Is that an argument that's raised in your brief?
Yes, it is. This court should find that error was committed that requires reversal. Additional language in a jury instruction such as this would have aided the jury in understanding that use of alcohol, contrary to the expert statement, does not expressly preclude, even under a set of circumstances in which the subject would be inebriated. The General Assembly could have defined the 641 by precluding intoxication. They did not. I should note that the second argument here, because my client was convicted of two separate counts of murder, the second would be the count of murder that resulted from the burglary first conviction. As I noted in my introduction, my client was a resident of this apartment with Crystal Moody and voluntarily decided to leave.
He lived there with her permission, correct?
He lived there based upon a discussion between the two of them, which resulted in her permission for him residing there.
Which she revoked.
She did revoke that. Orally, she revoked that. Yes, Your Honor.
And told him to get out.
She asked him to leave. He voluntarily leave, I would assert that the record reflects. But in an oral contract such as this, that would not be a revocation of any type of residential right that he would have. And we're looking here at the issue of
what are you saying? He had some vested right to be there whether she wanted him to be there or not?
Well, this is, we're
please
looking
answer
at the
my question as I phrased it.
Justice, I'm sorry, could you repeat?
Are you arguing that he had a vested right to be in that house whether Ms. Moody wanted him there or not, and even if she told him to get out?
I contend that, Your Honor, although I don't think you necessarily even need to adopt that in order to decide that he still had a privilege to be able to remain.
Okay, so your response is maybe he didn't have a vested right, but he had a privilege.
I assert he did have a vested right, and if he didn't have a vested right, then he still has a privilege.
Was that argument made to the trial court? And if so, how was it addressed by the trial court?
That was not made. Having a vested right was not made to the trial court. Having the application of the rule of lenity to the definition of privilege was raised in a motion in limine.
What does the...
A motion for judgment of acquittal post-trial.
The privilege argument was raised in a motion for judgment of acquittal post-trial.
Yes. And, Your Honor, I see.
I just have one question before you leave. I'm a little bit confused about the definition of extreme emotional distress as it applies to these facts, because it appears to say that a defendant can't rely on extreme emotional distress if the accused was culpably responsible or by any provocation, event, or situation for which the accused was culpably responsible, or when there's no causal relation between the provocation and the cause of the extreme emotional. How does your client going in and confronting three members of the household and then shooting them satisfy that definition?
That's a very good question. First, the purpose of him entering had nothing to do with any criminal intent. It was an argument that exploded, and this was contribution towards the argument by the victims here, so that this is not a situation in which the argument itself was 100% at the volition of Mr. Hamilton. The argument itself was started upon the point of which Mr. Hamilton was not given back the Sony PlayStation and was told to leave anyway.
Thank you.
And his state of mind itself was not contributed to by the alcohol usage, as we've indicated. I should also note the defense expert, his opinion was that the alcohol itself was not a factor that affected his state of mind. So we do believe that we presented overall sufficient evidence to find extreme emotional distress.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I would like to start where I just left off. Does the state concede that there was a basis for a claim of extreme emotional distress under the language of the provision, the statute?
There was a basis to present the defense based on the expert's review, at least Dr. Mensch's review. He's permitted to present that defense and claim that he was acting under extreme emotional distress because of the factors that he enumerated, that his expert enumerated, and the state responded in kind with its own expert who reviewed essentially the same materials, spoke with the defendant, and determined, in fact, that he was not. But he's certainly permitted to
even if there's no causal relationship between the provocation, which caused the extreme emotional distress, and the victim?
I suppose that that was the argument, is that there, in fact, was a causal relationship.
Okay.
He's not prevented from presenting that. So may it please the Court, Andrew Vella for the State. The trial court did not err when it initially allowed Dr. Raskin, permitted Dr. Raskin to testify about voluntary intoxication on direct. The court did not abuse its discretion.
Did Dr. Raskin make an accurate or inaccurate statement of the law?
It was an inaccurate statement of the law. It was inaccurate and incomplete. But the judge cautioned the jury at that point that this was Dr. Raskin's understanding of the law, that they would be getting the law from the court during the final instructions to the jury. And that wasn't the first time that the judge had to say that, because on direct of Dr. Mensch, who was the defense's expert, the defense elicited testimony that was essentially the same sort of opinion testimony. Well, how do you see how the statute operates? What is the standard under the statute? The defense, in fact, tried to read in portions of the statute during Dr. Mensch's direct, and the court interrupted, saying that the court was concerned with doing that because the court again told the jury, the court is going to give you the instructions on the law on extreme emotional distress.
Did his statement come out on direct, that he misunderstood his inaccurate statement of the law? Did that come out on direct examination?
Dr. Raskin's?
Yes.
It came out on direct. The judge cautioned the jury at that point. And then on cross-examination, the defendant compounded the error by asking a question that elicited the same response.
So even though there was no immediate curative instruction, there was a cautionary instruction of sorts.
Yes, there was.
All right. And then when the time came to instruct the jury on the law at the close of the evidence, the judge did address that issue. Mr. Christie says that the instruction the judge gave was legally inadequate. Can you address that point?
The state's position is that it was not legally inadequate. The defendant is not entitled to a perfect jury instruction. He's entitled to a correct and accurate statement of the law, and he's not entitled to a particular instruction, just a correct one. And in this case, the judge correctly set out Section 641 for the jury, correctly set out the voluntary intoxication portion of the statute, read it word for word, and added, at the defense's request, a sentence. The only change that the trial judge made to the sentence that was requested, and I can read it, the defense requested the additional sentence that says, the fact that a person has consumed alcohol does not preclude a finding of extreme emotional distress. What the court read to the jury was, the fact that a person has consumed alcohol does not necessarily preclude a finding of extreme emotional distress. So he got the instruction he asked for with the addition of one word. And that was a correct statement of the law, because extreme emotional distress under the statute, if someone has been drinking, it doesn't necessarily preclude consideration of the defense.
As I understand the appellant's argument, he asked for more to be told to the jury, and it was error not to give that.
What the defendant asked for in terms of more was additional words in a sentence. The sentence that he wanted would have read, if the defendant's mental state was caused by voluntary intoxication, and this is the additional language, and not by extreme emotional distress is not applicable. The court refused to add those six words, and not by extreme emotional distress. And the state suggests that was within the court's purview. The court did not need to unnecessarily confuse the jury. The court gave an instruction that addressed the issue that was at trial, the facts at trial, how the testimony came out. It was a correct and accurate statement of the law, which is what the defendant was entitled to. And the court certainly did not abuse its discretion giving that correct statement of the law to the jury.
I hope it's never necessary to confuse the jury.
I I don't believe it is necessary to confuse the jury. With regard to the burglary argument, the question for this court is whether any rational trier of fact, viewing the evidence in the light most favorable to the state, could find a defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, you had the defendant who was kicked out of his house by Crystal Moody, the house that he shared with her. It was her house. She agreed to let him live there. She kicked him out a month before the murder. On the night of the murder, he called asking to come over, and she had previously told him he was not allowed in the house. If she wasn't there, he wasn't allowed to come and pick up his stuff if she wasn't there. On the night of the murder, he called up. She told him she didn't want him there. She had advised her children not to let him in, and because children are children, they let him in when he showed up at the door. Christopher let him in. That doesn't mean he had a right to be there or a privilege to be there. The defense argues that the rule of lenity should apply when we're discussing the term privilege, because he claims it's ambiguous. It's undefined. It's not ambiguous.
Other than the payment of the utilities, was there any testimony at trial that there was an oral agreement to allow him to reside there for a certain period of time or anything like that?
That is the only testimony that the state would suggest supports such a finding. The testimony regarding the bills, the utility bills.
So there was no testimony about an oral agreement for a lease?
None that the state is aware of. The defense might have some other things that they can point to in the record that would indicate, but the state would suggest that's the only evidence that he occasionally helped out with a bill.
Did the defendant testify?
In this case?
Yes.
I believe he did. The fact of the matter is, with the burglary, he wasn't allowed to be there. He went there, and while inside, he committed the crimes that he committed.
Well, let me interrupt you just for a moment.
Sure.
You're saying you believe he testified. Did he testify that he had some understanding with Ms. Moody
about
his right to be in the apartment?
I am unaware of that, Justice Jacobs. He claims that he had a privilege to be there to retrieve his things. The state would suggest that he did not have a privilege to be there. He was told he could not be there before he went to the home. While he was in the home, he was told to leave. He refused to leave. He was told repeatedly by Crystal, by Tyrone, and then he decided to push Crystal. That's when Tyrone got involved, and that's when the gun came out. He did not have any privilege to be there, and if this court were to find that he had some privilege to be there, that privilege was revoked immediately once he committed a crime inside by pushing Crystal Moody. So the state would suggest that there was sufficient evidence to find Paris Hamilton guilty of burglary in the first degree beyond a reasonable doubt. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. If I can use an analogy of there was a couple, and a couple started dating, and the woman ended up moving in with the man in an apartment, and she resided with the man in the apartment, decided to have a cable bill and hook up Verizon so that they could have telephone service rather than just a cell phone and cable. And 2 years into this relationship, it's not going well. And the man is paying the lion's share of the money and says, please move out. I don't want you in here anymore. That is an oral contract. That is a...
Did Crystal Moody concede that?
Yes, she did.
That what?
Paris Hamilton never testified. Crystal Moody, during the early part of her testimony, described how she was disappointed that Paris Hamilton was not contributing the fair share of financial resources to the household. And that was one of the major components in her deciding to ask him to leave.
Did she believe she had the right to ask him to leave?
Well, I would assert she certainly did have the right to ask him to leave, but what she didn't do is she didn't take the steps to terminate what would have been a legal right to remain there.
What are you saying, that she had to go to the Justice of the Peace Court and get a summary possession order?
That would have been one mechanism, but there was no law enforcement called, no allegation of protection from abuse and a separation to prevent Mr. Hamilton from residing there or returning there. There was no unlawful act for Mr. Hamilton to return, especially to retrieve his goods.
How was this issue, this claim that your client had a legal right or privilege to stay in the apartment even though he was told to leave, get presented to the court and the jury? I mean, it's almost a property right argument. And
Your Honor, candidly, being a criminal defense lawyer and in a trial like this, your mind is constantly spinning. That this was a concept that, based upon the evidence that was presented, was made in a motion for judgment of acquittal. And an argument was not made for a definition of privilege within the jury instructions. But nevertheless, it still is a valid argument.
It was made pre-verdict.
It was made post-verdict.
Post-verdict.
But within a motion for judgment of acquittal.
But how did the evidence even come in? Your client didn't testify, right?
Correct. All of the evidence about what Mr. Hamilton was contributing to the finances was through the state's witnesses. Crystal Moody, I believe, outlined everything, including the fact of the payment of the Verizon bill. And the Verizon bill, at the moment that he entered, was still under his name.
But
Crystal Moody never took...
Wait a second. Because somebody who has ownership of a piece of property allows somebody else to come in and pay the Verizon bill, that constitutes an oral agreement to give that person a tenancy there? Is that what you're saying?
I would say, well, that would be a factor towards it. Because someone could do that under a state of just generosity, a benefactor saying, I'll pay this bill for you. But this was an agreement between Crystal Moody and Paris Hamilton that he would take care of certain financial responsibilities and she would take
care of
mine.
Did she testify that he had some tenancy of some term of time?
No, but that is clear under operation of law that a person who has an oral contract to be residing in a place. In fact, the morning that...
But who testified that there was an oral contract? That's what I'm asking.
I would say the totality of her testimony was that she had an agreement with Paris Hamilton that he could reside there. And what he needed to fulfill was his financial end of the agreement, which he did not. But just as if a tenant in a property breaches their financial obligation, that their right to remain in the premises is not ended just by that fact. It would only be ended when there would be a legal mechanism to terminate that.
Well, I can understand how you would make that argument if Ms. Moody actually testified that because Hamilton was paying for the whatever the electronic devices were in the Wi-Fi bill and all that he would be entitled to be physically in the apartment. I could understand that if she conceded that by way of testimony, but that's really an inference that you're asking somebody to draw from the bare fact that he was paying the bills.
Well, correct? First, I would say that Crystal Moody, it wasn't a clear division of what he'd need to be contributing. He needed to contribute enough. He was not contributing enough. In this dialogue that we're having, the rule of lenity would support a definition of the word privilege that is more beneficial to the defense.
I have no idea what the connection is between the rule of lenity and privilege. Now, the rule of lenity is that the jury can basically nullify what would otherwise be a guilty verdict. You know, how that bears on privilege, an argument that wasn't made either to the jury or to the court before the verdict, I don't understand.
It bears on privilege, and for the same reason of the example that I gave you, is because in this situation, if he has no right to be there, and if he is told to leave, then there is no question burglary one would have been met. In this instance, just like if this was the female within a relationship, she comes back, she voluntarily left, she's now coming back to get her belongings, and an argument ensues between the two of them. The man says, get out now. That doesn't turn her act if she emotionally explodes,
well,
gets
leaving,
a gun out and shoots him.
Aren't you leaving out a critical fact? Your client voluntarily left when told to get out. Isn't that basically an amendment or an agreement that the whatever right that existed to be there was ended?
No. It was simply that he understood he wasn't contributing his fair share. He left. In fact, there's testimony of a conversation that he had with Crystal Moody. Can I come home? He still considered that place to be his home. His name was on the bills. He had most of his personal property there, and he had, in particular, the belongings that he sought.
Does the evidence allow the jury to infer that it was ended?
I understand juries can infer a lot, and if you ask me whether there is enough evidence for a jury to infer that it was ended, I would say yes, but we're talking about a legal definition now, which would have been the termination of a property right that Mr. Hamilton had.
Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement, and we will adjourn for the day.